Good morning, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. This is WILP's Wake Up Call. WILP is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and I am Lori Hoyt, and Dick Paddock is our engineer. And today we're going to replay a tape about that we had Dr. Jonathan Koch here about healthcare reform, because this is still such an important issue that we're all struggling with. And want to tell you about a program that we're going to be co-sponsoring that will help sort out some of the confusion that we, even when we're paying attention, that we all have. What is in the current legislation, and what do, and this program that we're going to have is not going to be one of those town hall meetings with a debate. It's really a teach-in, a progressive agenda. It's called a healthcare reform, a progressive agenda. And it's going to be next Tuesday, September 29th, from 7 to 9 o'clock, at the Owassa Community Room, which is at 400 Jones Ferry Road in Carrboro. I think you all know where Jones Ferry Road is, right by the thrift shop in Carrboro. And if you go into the parking lot at Owassa, the community room is at the far left in the lower level. There's plenty of parking, and it's going to be a really neat program. So please tell people about it and try to come. We're going to have some really good speakers. Heidi Kober, the president of Progressive Democrats, is going to be speaking, and Michael Perlmutter, who's very knowledgeable about this, Adam Searing, director of North Carolina Health Access Coalition, and Adam Sotak, organizing director for Democracy North Carolina. So this is going to lay out with a lot of clarity what's in the current legislation, and then what do progressives want in there, what do we want to fight for or struggle for, and some tools on how to do that. Lots of good information so that we can go out. It is still time. It's not too late to get up with our legislators and to try to get a really robust public option in that plan, which will be critical, as most of us know, and you know that it's a real healthcare reform and not just tinkering with a few of the insurance regulations. So please try to come. Please tell people about it. We're here at WCOM LP, and we have an underwriter, Internationalist Bookstore, at 405 West Franklin Street. And you can learn more about it online, internationalistbooks.org. And we're going to play a tape in just a few minutes from Dr. Jonathan Koch, who's a UNC doctor, who will give you a lot of good information about healthcare. So don't forget, healthcare reform, a progressive agenda, next Tuesday, it's September 29th, 7 to 9 o'clock, Owassa Community Room. I hope to see you there. And now let's go to Dr. Jonathan Koch.
Good morning, and welcome to your WILF Wake Up Call. My name's Tana Hartman. I'm your host this morning for the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Our engineer today is Dick Paddock, and our guest is Dr. Jonathan Koch, professor of maternal and child health at the UNC Gillings Global School of Public Health, and he is also president of Healthcare for All, NC. Welcome, Dr. Koch.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
As just about everybody knows now, the healthcare system in the U.S. is in a terrible mess. We spend more than any other industrialized nation, and our coverage is worse, and we have growing numbers of uninsured. We have something like 46 million now uninsured nationwide, and in North Carolina alone, there are nearly 2 million, 1.8, I think was the figure. the majority, as you pointed out just a little while ago, of those are the uninsured are not those who are unemployed, but those who are in working families, families where one parent may have a job but has lost coverage through their employer, or even where coverage is available, benefits are being cut, and premiums and co-pays and co-insurance are all going up. So people are having more and more trouble getting, making the decision even to get medications they might need or procedures they might need. You have spent a long, long time advocating for children and families, for health care. What is there any fix for this? I mean, what will the, for instance, the reauthorization of the S-CHIP bill, which President Obama signed on in February of this year, what will that do? Will that help things? Will that fix things? It can't take care of the growing numbers, can it?
No, it can't, and it never has. I mean, S-CHIP was a very important adjunct to opportunities for health care coverage for families that would be considered medically indigent, that is, families that earn too much money to be eligible for Medicaid, but we're not earning enough to be able to afford private health insurance. So for that group, which I believe went up to about 250% of poverty in the previous version of S-CHIP, the opportunity to participate in this program meant that those children in that slice of the income continuum between Medicaid eligibility and ability to purchase health insurance could get health insurance. It was a good plan. The North Carolina plan was a model plan among all of the plans in the United States.
Was it?
And, you know, we covered, I don't know, maybe 70, 80, 90,000 children at its peak. But it was a discretionary plan. The states had the opportunity to enfranchise more or fewer children according to their generosity. North Carolina had to start cutting back as the budget began to get sour, and S-CHIP itself expired at the national level and was not reauthorized under the previous administration. So if President Obama and the new Congress hadn't passed and signed the new legislation, S-CHIP would have went out of business entirely in March, I think. It turns out that now the new S-CHIP legislation increased the upper limit that the states could bring families into the program to.
What do
about
you mean, upper limit?
The upper limit of income. So a family income of 300% of poverty, I believe, is now the upper limit at which people could be eligible for S-CHIP. But on the other hand, that's at the discretion of the state. It isn't a mandate. So the state isn't obliged to enfranchise all families up to that level. And in fact, under present circumstances, it's not likely that there will be any expansion of S-CHIP.
None whatsoever.
I doubt it. You know, there's no money for it.
The North Carolina S-CHIP is called NC Health Choice. Tell us a little bit about the history of that, because that was a long battle, wasn't it?
Well, it was not a bitter battle. I think it was a struggle, you might say, to come up with a plan. The federal government gave states the opportunity to choose between a program that looked very much like Medicaid or a program that looked rather more like a health insurance plan. North Carolina went in the direction of a plan that looked more like private health insurance, including a sliding scale for purchasing into the plan. So people who were right above the limit for Medicaid, the poorest group in that medically indigent population, would get NC Health Choice for free, but as their incomes approached 250% of poverty, then they would be paying a premium. It would be a reduced premium, but the subsidy would go down as the family income increased.
Just so we have an idea, what is the federal poverty level now?
I'm going to say, I could be way off about this, for a family of four, about $24,000 a year.
Okay, I think that's sounds right to me, too, but it's in the 20s anyway.
Playing you one of our tapes about health care, because we wanted to get you excited about our program next Tuesday, Health Care Reform, a Progressive Agenda. But we also have one of our dear friends and favorite senators, state senator here today, and we're going to talk about prisons and mothers in prison, and maybe a little bit about some prison sentencing reform. We have Ellie Kinnaird, our state senator. Welcome, Ellie. We're so glad you're here.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm pleased to hear you talk about the healthcare, and I usually carry with me the telephone numbers for Hagen, Burr, and Price, and tell everybody to call and tell them to support the public option and the cost containment, but I left it in the car. Sorry.
And I left mine at home, so that's something we'll definitely have to do, because I had a message from President Obama wanting us to call Kay Hagen and make sure that she supports the plan he outlined on September 9th that includes a robust public option. So I think he's finally going to really get out there and fight for it, I certainly hope. But anyhow, we want to talk to you today.
Okay.
About prison and mothers and your work to kind of help mothers with babies and small children.
Well, thank you. It's a wonderful program. Right now it's on hold because the state took our money away for our construction program, but I'll describe the program and describe the problem. I worked for many years for Prisoner Legal Services, which helps prisoners with legal problems in the prison, nothing to do with criminal law. And we did a survey of women prisoners to find out what their concerns were, and of course it was their children. Most of the people who are in prison, this includes men, have children. And when the mother goes to prison, it is a severe break with the bond between the mother and the child. If they're lucky, they have a grandmother or another relative who can take care of that child while they're in prison. If they're not lucky, social services takes the child, and sometimes they're just scattered without even any, and there's no supervision, no follow-up, nobody knows what happens to those children. And more seriously, if they have a caretaker while they're in prison, that caretaker and the child, who's already suffering the trauma of losing the mother, form a bond. So when the mother gets out of prison, the child does not want to be taken away from the caretaker, and one more wrenching disturbance in their secure life. So what we are doing is we are building a facility in Butner which will house women prisoners, nonviolent crimes, which, by the way, most women are in for nonviolent crimes. They're usually property crimes. Sadly, they are to support a drug habit. And so what happens is they're in for a fairly short time, usually 1 to 2 years, which is ideal for our program. If they come into the program pregnant, which many do, the child is born while they're in prison, and as it stands now, the child is taken away in 24 hours.
Oh,
and those of us who are mothers can't even imagine the wrench that would occur and the terrible sadness and grief. So what we would do is those people who come in pregnant or with young children will go to a facility where they will have the best care, the best programs for both the mother and the child. The mother will have therapy, group therapy, drug therapy, employment help, educational opportunities if they can take advantage of them. The child, and we're working with the Frank Porter Graham Center, who set up a program for us, mm-hmm. will have the most safe, secure, and enriched program that they can have. And most importantly, the mother will learn how to be a good parent with the child right there on side.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people say, you know, children in prison, well, first of all, this is not a prison. That was rejected early on when we planned this. There are 7 states who have these programs, and 5 of them actually have on-site in the prison. But that was rejected. So we have a building in Butner. Used to be the Murdoch Center, if anybody knows that, mm-hmm. for the developmentally disabled.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will have them house the mother and the children there with all the best help we can get.
That is just, you know, it's amazing that it hasn't happened before. I remember seeing a program in Canada where they have cottages for the mothers and children. It was almost like a little village, and they could go outside and stroll around, and it was the most wonderful thing. And so it sounds like you're working really hard that we have something like that here. It's something that's long overdue, it sounds like. But you started out saying the money was cut?
Well, what happened was we were able to get $3.5 million. We've gotten money from David Price.
And good.
Over the years, the Governor's Crime Commission, the Z. Smith Reynolds, all this was for planning and putting it together.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got money for staff members, and we have one full-time staff member. The organization, by the way, is called Our Children's Place, and I want to tell you about the hats.
Our
Children's Place, and I want to tell you about the hats that the prisoners have knit. And how it got started. And by the way, this has been cooking for over 20 years, well, since the 80s. And But, you know, the prisons are desperate, like everybody else, to just do core services, and that wasn't certainly a core service. As one of the Department of Correction people told me, the Department of Correction is not in the business of raising babies. And so, of course, we had to get, ours is a nonprofit, and we get money for the children's part someplace else. We'll get per diem for the women prisoners. But early on when we started this program, a member of the United Church of Christ was an artist and wanted to work with prisoners, and she started a knitting program. And people have donated yarn over the years. And she started a program with them, and they started to knit hats. And they have knit hats and knit hats and knit hats, and they're all, as you can imagine, donated yarn, all different colors and sizes and shapes and patterns, and they're as cute as can be. And that's our signature, because those women prisoners know that that's going to help them raise money for the children's program. And so
I remember, didn't Weaver Street a year or so ago have a big exhibit with all the hats hung
they
up?
They did.
They were just beautiful.
And they are really lovely. Well, the first Sunday in December, we are having our fundraiser at the, and this is at the Carolina Inn. And we will display the hats. And the hats are there not for sale, because prisoners can't sell things. So what we do is ask for a donation, and you can take any hat for any amount of money.
First Saturday in December?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just in time for the winter season.
Yes, and Christmas.
And Christmas. And if the people want to donate but don't want to take a hat, they can donate the hat to the children's hospital. So the hats will end up. And the prisoners themselves are so pleased with this program and what it will mean to them in future.
Oh, I'm so sure. You know, you're sitting there and you're grieving and upset about your children, and to have something to do,
right?
That's positive like that. That's who's that? This was this woman who's an artist. It was her idea.
The hats, yeah. And it has grown and grown. And back to the fundraiser. The reason I mentioned the fundraiser is that the children's part is paid for with private donations.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have money from the state for a staff member, and we had another for a half-time staff member to do programming, but that part was cut. But more seriously, we had $3.5 million for renovation of the facility, and that's what was taken up. In this budget crisis, the governor took everything. She took the Clean Water Management Trust Fund, she took the Rainy Day Fund, she took all funds were just scooped up. And we're going to go meet with her, we hope, in a couple of weeks and ask if we could please just have our little $3.5 million. Because we're ready to go out to bids.
So you have the building, but it needs a lot of renovation to make it a really good place for these children and the mothers. But, you know, it's so frustrating, and I'm sure you're frustrated with how much is done instead of prevention, because I read somewhere that children whose parents have been in prison are much more vulnerable to end up in the prison system themselves, and you can see why with the trauma, and maybe a double trauma, both when the mother goes into prison and when she gets out, and being torn between a caregiver and the mother. And so this is like to prevent, and it's going to be cost savings. People need to think in those terms, and they don't. We're so short-sighted.
Right. The recidivism rate of these people, we have it from other states, is very low. That very few of them go back to prison, whereas in the regular population, it's quite high.
Yeah.
Who do go back to prison over and over again.
Yeah.
But this forms such a bond and helps them through rough patches and makes them a whole family. So this really is. And, of course, in the budget cuts, they cut everything. They cut, for instance, recreation staff for the prison system, not just the women's prison, but all prison. Visitation staff has been cut. They've cut absolutely everything that can be cut. And people don't realize how profound this budget crisis was, but it's been very difficult on prevention programs. Exactly what you're talking.
Yes.
All the prevention programs, the drug programs were cut.
Yeah, I've heard about stuff for juveniles. A lot of mental health programs that are like group homes and things that
That's
are
right.
to keep them from getting into more restrictive environments, like a prison, youth
right.
prison kind of environment. It's just heartbreaking, and I think we're going to pay a tremendous social cost.
Oh yeah.
But you mentioned earlier on about a lot of the women who were nonviolent offenders,
mm-hmm.
and I wonder, with or without children, what kind of other programs, drug programs in the prison to help people, an employment program so when they get out they have a chance of succeeding?
Well, there have been drug programs, fewer of them in the women's prison than in the men's prison.
Really?
There are 42,000 men and 2,000 women in prison. You can see the proportion.
Mm.
of and most of the women are nonviolent crimes, obviously.
Mm.
But most of the drug programs have either been cut or cut back. We did increase one for women, but I'm not sure whether that money is still there.
Mm-hmm.
Because the governor then said... 2 weeks ago, they have to all cough up 5% more of their budgets to turn back in. And so we're in very difficult straits. And I also want to say one thing that we're working on now is raising the age of trying children as adults from 16 to 18. There are only two other states, and one of them's transitioning. But we try children as adults when they're 16.
Oh, that's
now,
terrible.
We know from brain studies that
yes.
the brain is not formed. They don't have judgment. They can't resist peer pressure. And they're impulsive. And as a result, what happens is they do a lot of stupid things at
yes.
that, and then they pay for it for the rest of their lives. They can't get a job.
And any parent who's raised any teenagers knows exactly
right.
what those brain studies are showing, and hopefully you can hold on to them enough that they don't get, you know, into more serious trouble with the law. But when it is a middle-class kid who does get into a little trouble with either drinking or pot use or whatever, then that parent usually can afford a lawyer, and that mm-hmm. kid's record is protected. But poorer kids, they get into then the prison pipeline. And once you're
mm-hmm.
into that, you as a young person, you get that self-image, you know. I'm a bad guy. I'm, you know. And it's just so easy, especially with the lack of good employment possibilities, mm-hmm. to stay in that prison pipeline. Yeah, that's a tragedy. So we're one of only two states.
Right. We're hoping to raise that. Now, I want to say that our juvenile... department has gone to an entirely new direction, and that is a therapeutic model of treating these children.
Oh.
And by the way, at 40 to 60% of the children in the juvenile system have serious mental health problems.
Uh-huh.
And so we're going to a therapeutic model instead of just warehousing them. And everybody from the cook on to the director is taught how to meet a situation with a child, a confrontation, appropriately, so that they're not just thrown into a single cell, you know, but they are actually helping to work the child to work through the situation and to come out at the other end and be able to go into society knowing how to deal with these very serious problems. It's interesting, when I went around to try to get my expunction bill to expunge crimes from people who've been crime-free for 10 years, so many of the legislators, the male legislators I've talked to, said, oh boy, but for the grace of God, there go I, when I was that age and just did something but didn't get caught.
Yes.
And we know that that is a vulnerable age, especially for boys.
Oh boy. Well, so you're working on the expungement bill, which is wonderful. So it's not there yet.
No, so, a lot of resistance. People who are running for office don't want to be seen as soft on crime, and it's terrible to try to get this through.
It's an attitude that, I don't know, I think it's peculiar to this country in terms of the other industrialized nations, that we have such a punitive attitude.
Oh, absolutely.
And we pay the price. we pay the price with people then not getting the kind of treatment that they could get in prison, young or old, mm-hmm. with drug treatment or whatever, and then coming out and the recidivism rate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and somehow, I don't know when we're going to learn.
I know. It's very, we need to.
Thank goodness you're there to help us learn and help keep raising the issue.
Well, I'm lucky. I come from Orange County, where we always have a real valued attitude towards what we're doing, and
yeah.
I'm very appreciative of that. So
yeah.
it's a difficult situation, and we hope that we will mature as a society, but we don't look like we're going that direction, do we, with the healthcare fuss that's going on?
Well, you know, I'm not going to give up some hope that that the worst of that is over, that people are going to get tired of the screamers mm-hmm. and misinformation, and we're trying to do something about that with having a program next Tuesday. I've said about it earlier in the program, and it is not a town hall meeting. It is not a debate. It is a teach-in with mm-hmm. a progressive agenda to clarify what's in the legislative bills, because even those of us who try to pay attention are a little fuzzy mm-hmm. about, and then what do progressives want to be sure is in there, and then the tools mm-hmm. on how to work for that.
That's
so it's
great.
Going to be a lot of great information. It's going to be at the Owassa Community Room on Jones Ferry Road mm-hmm. Next Tuesday, September 29th, from 7 to 9. So that I'm still hopeful. When I got that message from the local Obama people, Diane Robertson, saying the president wants me to call you mm-hmm. and wants you to call Kay Hagan and tell her that he wants her to support his September 9th address that includes a robust public option. So I'm hoping that he's finally going to kind of stand up for what we elected him for, and mm-hmm. that Kay Hagan has the courage, I know she's under pressure, to stand up for what she is at least saying she will stand up for, a robust public option.
You know, when people call their congresspeople, they don't have to get into a conversation. They don't have to know the points. They don't have to. The phone will be answered by an intern.
Yes,
I know. The intern will say, thank you very much. I'll pass that along to the senator or the mm-hmm. representative. So don't feel like you have to have the knowledge that to carry on a conversation.
That's a good
you
point.
Won't. They don't want to talk with you. They don't have time. They just want to find out how many people are for this and how many people are for that. So every phone call counts.
Yeah, and I know Jerry Marcatus, one of our activist friends, asked, I think it was David Price's office, how often is it okay to call when you don't feel it's intrusive or being too pesky? And they said once a week was okay. And that was a big wake-up call to me, because I thought, well, I've made my call.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you can call each week and say, yes, I'm for the public option, or yes, I'm for whatever the issue is. That's a good point, though, not to say too much. You don't need to know too much.
No, you just have to say you support, ask them to support it. I wouldn't call the same person every week, though, because they're going to say, oh, no, here they come again.
Here they come again.
But get a different person to call as often as possible, and mm-hmm. that's the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
David Price told Verlinsko one day that he was getting more calls against. This is when the big furor over the town meetings, and so they had a push on,
mm-hmm.
but he said he was getting more calls against the public option or the whole plan, and so we've got to remember to keep it going.
We got to keep with David Price. Well, we're kind of getting out of time a little bit. Is there any last word that you want to say about the prison reform that you're working on in different aspects? Is there any place that people can get more information?
Absolutely. I want to say that what we're trying to do is look over the whole sentencing system and the whole way we approach crime. We are hiring the National Institute of Justice, I think, that has done excellent work in other places. And what they do is they look at your statistics and they focus on an area and they say, this is a high crime area. Put all your resources in there. And then be careful that it doesn't pop out in another area. They have been able to cut down from 40 to 60% criminal activity in a state which keeps you from getting into prison. Then we'd also like to say these low-level drug offenses, those people shouldn't be in prison. We need to get them, as you say, prevention programs, get them early. And we can't afford $27,000 a year for someone who should be out on the in the community.
And so that they could be on probation and in a therapeutic drug program, which would be very inexpensive. Okay, well, we're with a WCOM.org. Wait a minute, WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. And this is Lori Hoyt speaking for WILF, the Women's International League for Peace.